Hello and welcome along to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for the weekly show here on Premier Christian Radio that brings you conversations that matter. Ones that aim to get you thinking, and often between participants who are leaders in their field. And we've got a particular theological life that we're going to be looking at today on the programme. I'll introduce my guests in a moment's time. Just a note to say, lots of response to last week's edition of the show on the scientific issue of the multiverse and the evidence for it. We're going to be lining up another show on that very soon. I'll be telling you about that a bit later on today. Later on after today's show, don't miss The Profile. Between 4 and 5, John Pantry speaks to composer and musician Keith Getty. He's the man behind some amazing hymns, songs that are sung all over the world in churches, including, of course, In Christ Alone, which he co-authored with Stuart Townend. So listen out for that between 4 and 5 this afternoon. You'll hear more about the Rethinking Hell conference that I'm hosting a little later on in today's show, as we hear from conference organisers Chris Date and John Tancock as well. And don't forget, if you go to the Unbelievable website, you can get hold of today's show, lots of past shows, subscribe to the podcast, see all the resources and extra features, and, of course, the special Unbelievable conference on DVD took place earlier this year. We want you to get hold of it, whether it be the DVD, MP3, CD or the digital download. All the links available there. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable. Let's get into today's programme. You're unbelievable. Well, today on the programme, we're asking Søren Kierkegaard, who was he and what did he do for modern theology? We're having a conversation between two eminent theologians today joining me on the programme. They are Stephen Backhouse and Jane Williams. Stephen is lecturer in social and political theology at St. Melitus College, London, and he's the author of a brand new book on Kierkegaard called Kierkegaard, A Single Life, available at kierkegaardbook.com. Jane Williams is Assistant Dean and Lecturer in Systematic Theology at St. Melitus College, and I'm sure we'll hear a bit about the college as well in the course of the programme. Jane also hosts God Pod, that's a very popular podcast, with Graham Tomlin, the President of St. Melitus, and it's a pleasure to welcome you both onto my radio show and podcast today. Thank you for coming along.
Good to be here. Yes, thank you, Justin. You.
It's great to have you both. I am a regular listener to the God Pod, so I have heard both of your voices in that respect, and it's nice to meet fellow podders. I don't know what you call us, podcasters, I suppose. Just tell us a little bit about the background for you both. Stephen, first of all, how long have you been at St. Melitus teaching there?
So I have been at St. Melitus for 7 years, I think, coming up to 7 years. And before that, I lived in Oxford, where I was an academic. And before that, I lived in Canada.
Oh, wow.
Where I was a teenager.
I see. Which explains the slightly transatlantic,
very strange accent. Yes.
Accent there.
Yeah.
Great. Has Kierkegaard been influential from early on, or is it just something you've recently gotten to?
Yes, I mean, I discovered him when I was working in a bookshop in England. One of my first jobs was a bookseller.
Right.
And I was working through my, I used my employee discount to work through the world's classics, and that's
wow.
how I discovered
okay.
Kierkegaard.
We'll be hearing all about him. Your own faith, has it been with you since childhood? Were you an adult?
Well, I like perhaps a lot of listeners, I grew up born again.
Mm-hmm.
But then I went through a phase when I moved to Britain, actually, where I kind of realised that Christianity was perhaps bigger and deeper than just the culture that I grew up in. So it wasn't a crisis of faith, but it definitely was a time when I came to own Christianity in a different way than
right.
what I'd grown up with.
Yes, your horizons were expanded a bit.
Yes, and Kierkegaard helped me with that.
Okay, that's interesting to hear. Jane, welcome along to the programme.
Thank you.
I've wanted to have you on for so long as well, so it's great to have you on at last. I've had your husband on, but not you as yet.
Well, that's a bit of a pattern, I'm afraid.
You were recently, though, involved at Premier, delivering our Premier lecture back in June. Very briefly, what was the topic you were speaking on then?
The title was Being a First Century Christian in 21st Century Britain. So I was trying to bring out some of what would have struck contemporaries as strange about the earliest church and trying to see if there are lessons for us in our modern situation about what characterised that first church.
We've been doing the Book of Acts at our church. My wife's been preaching through it sort of fairly systematically. And it's just the most rip-roaring adventure,
it
basically,
really is.
Isn't it?
Yes.
It's fantastic for preaching on, actually.
But also doesn't idealise the church.
No.
And I think that's something that we can forget when we're thinking about the first century church.
Mm, absolutely. Well, it's lovely to have you on. As I say, I've long been a listener to GodPod as well. I think there's a lot of overlap between the shows we do. Obviously, Unbelievable tends to be more putting two people in debate against each other. Now, I don't conceive today is going to be quite as necessarily combative as some of our episodes are. But essentially, it's a discussion show, GodPod as well, where you bat around ideas and talk about theology, and often it's prompted by listener questions and that sort of thing. You've had something like over 200 episodes now, is that right? Or am I getting that completely wrong?
I think we've had our 100th.
100th, sorry. Yes. It was the 100th episode, yes, is what I was thinking, yes, of. Yes, yes, that was a special one. Extra special biscuits or something,
exactly,
brought out,
yes,
for that one.
And yes, I mean, we just discovered that, the three of us who founded St. Miletus College thought we didn't want to lose the joy of talking about theology. So we used to sit down once a week and just chat theologically. And Graham Tomlin, our president, thought, well, why not record this and see if other people enjoy it? And apparently they do.
It's great. It's great. I do recommend, if you enjoy Unbelievable in terms of the theological stuff you hear, go and subscribe to GodPod as well. And I'm sure you'll enjoy that as well. Very briefly, St. Miletus itself as a college just has grown extraordinarily quickly. It was only established, what, about a decade ago or so, wasn't it?
We celebrate our 10th birthday next year.
There you go.
Yes. We started with, I think, 9 students 10 years ago as an experiment licensed by the Church of England for a year to see if this was a way that we could train people for ordained ministry. And we now, this summer, 75 of our students were left to go and work in parishes and churches and ministries in the Church of England all over the country. So, yes, it has grown quite extraordinarily.
As I understand it, it has become the largest training college for Church of England ordinands. What's behind that sort of that growth?
Well, I think it's, I would want to say, the Holy Spirit.
Absolutely, yeah.
I think there are a couple of other things that really help. One is the central London location of one of our hubs. We train in the northwest in Liverpool Cathedral and in Chelmsford as well. But central London enables a lot of people to be able to travel in. Yeah. We're not residential, so people are able to be deeply embedded in a ministry while also training for ordination. So I think it's a combination of things. And yeah. I think...
And it's not just Anglican.
And it's not just Anglican.
Right.
We train other people
as
well. That's
probably a misconception often, that it's just Anglican training.
We only train people for Anglican ordained ministry, but we train Christians for the ministries that God is calling them to in whichever church they come from.
Great, great stuff. And you enjoy teaching students yourself, Stephen?
I do. I
most
love
of
teaching.
The time. Very often, I think, people think of theological college and people who write books about Kierkegaard are somehow maybe disconnected from real life. You know, that's all airy-fairy theology. I mean, what's the point of doing this stuff, I suppose, in terms of at the academic level?
Well, I would say the first thing I'd want to say is I'm not an academic.
Yeah, aren't you?
I'm not doing
your title makes it sound like you are. Lecturer in social and political theology.
I heard a friend of mine say this once. He said, I'm not an academic, but I am scholarly.
Okay.
And the idea of thinking carefully about things that are important is really important. Sometimes being an academic might mean shutting yourself away in the ivory tower, having nothing to do with real life. And we're, at St. Miletus, we're very deliberately not doing that. Mm. We very deliberately invite people to bring their practices to the classroom, and we look at it and we talk about it and we theologically, Christianly think about what they're actually doing in life, and then we send them out and they do their ministry and then they come back and we talk about it again. And so it's not we're very deliberately not separate from life.
Yeah.
So we're trying to think Christianly about living Christianly.
Yeah, well, all the very best. Now, I'm thrilled that that what you're seeing happen through St. Miletus, and it's marvellous. Let's talk about Kierkegaard, and we're going to be digging into this character who, I must confess, I know very little about myself, so I'm going to be playing the part of the average listener to this programme, who probably also knows very
little.
He's not
a household name.
He will be after this.
After this, yes, absolutely. But if you're listening and you'd like to feedback on anything you hear on today's programme, can I remind you of the email address? It's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also, of course, find the show on all the social media platforms, facebook.com/unbelievable. @UnbelievableJB or Twitter @UnbelievableJB is my handle. Let me know what you think about today's show. And don't forget, you can hear more feedback from recent shows towards the end of today's programme as well. This is Unbelievable. Find us at our website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So we're talking about Soren Kierkegaard. Now, firstly, Stephen, before I go any further, am I even pronouncing his name correctly?
Well, when I teach on this chap, I'm not a Danish speaker at all. I have had to learn to read Danish. And my Danish teacher, she said, I can teach you how to speak it or I can teach you how to read it. But we don't have time for both. Which one do you want? So it is very difficult to pronounce. But when I teach on this chap, I always ask if there's any Scandinavians in the crowd. And whenever there is, they tell me it's Soren Kierkegaard.
Kierkegaard.
Yes.
Okay, right.
So not guard.
Not guard. Yes. It's that double A. You never quite know what to do with
it. I confess,
that.
I'm mystified by it as well.
Well, that beside, apart from all of that,
yeah.
Again, it would be interesting to just get a little sense of what drew you to this character. He lived in the 19th century. As I say, many people won't have heard of him, but you think he's actually been rather influential in the way we think about Christianity
today. Yeah, you may not have heard of him, but I guarantee you, you've probably thought some of the thoughts that he introduced to us. So he is credited for introducing the idea of a leap of faith into our modern imagination, the idea that being authentic, so the idea that it's not just what you say that's important, you also have to walk the talk. I mean, his language of authenticity was something that he introduced to the modern Christian West. He is thought of as the father of existentialism, which is a school of philosophy which is a long word for just basically saying your existence matters. So it's a school of living and philosophy that says there's something about you that's more important than what group you were born into, what country you belong to, what church you're a part of. Your identity matters above and beyond whatever group you're a part of. And so he's credited with the beginning of that kind of idea. So if you ever believe that, you know, my choices matter or that I am more than just the sum of my group, then you are thinking along Kierkegaardian lines.
Well, we're going to delve into some of the various things that you think Kierkegaard was responsible for bringing out in terms of modern theology. And I'm sure there'll be lots to talk about between yourself and Jane on that front. Jane, you're coming not as an expert yourself on Kierkegaard, but to sort of be a foil for Stephen.
Though he has been hugely influential on people that I have studied in a bit more depth, for example.
You're talking about Kierkegaard rather than Stephen.
well, both, obviously. But in this case, Kierkegaard.
Yeah.
For example, Bonhoeffer,
yeah.
Who's somebody that more of us will have read.
Yes.
You can certainly see Kierkegaard's influence.
That's
there.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, again, Bonhoeffer is someone who I think has of late become suddenly lots of people talking about him, reading about him, perhaps more than in his own lifetime. Are you hoping perhaps to do the same that Eric Metaxas did for Bonhoeffer with his this one?
Part of my pitch to the publisher was that I want to do for Kierkegaard what Metaxas did for Bonhoeffer. So we're going to see if that works.
It will be interesting to see because he's not innately such an attractive character. Well,
I guess, you know, Bonhoeffer has that whole amazing life story that goes alongside his theology. I mean, tell us about the life of Kierkegaard and where that all began and what sort of family was he born into? What was the social class and what was going on around him at the time?
Well, do you know, maybe we could use Bonhoeffer as a jumping off point. So Bonhoeffer, as listeners might know, was a German pastor who was living under the Nazis. And Bonhoeffer was aware of the problem that the German church had mistaken its nationality for its Christianity, and it was endorsing this kind of racist Nazi ideology as a Christian movement. And Bonhoeffer found in Kierkegaard, there's a book that Kierkegaard wrote called Practice in Christianity, which was Kierkegaard's version of saying your nationality and your Christianity are different things, and being a Christian is not the same as being a civilized member of your European society. And so Bonhoeffer was really inspired by that book, and he in fact used that as an inspiration for his book Discipleship, or The Cost of Discipleship.
Right.
So the idea of cheap grace is actually a Kierkegaardian idea,
right,
and that kind of thing. So that sort of thing. And so that is a good window into what Kierkegaard was doing. As he grew up, I mean, he died in 1855, so mid-19th century.
Quite young, didn't he?
Yeah, he was 42 when he died. But he was a, you know, his father was a wool merchant. He was a respectable, upper-middle-class Copenhagen chap. He had a lovely fiance that everyone, you know, was expecting him to marry, and he loved, and she loved him, and he had a promising job career prospects. He was a studying for theology at the university, which meant a career track to be a priest in the established church of Denmark, which was the Lutheran Church.
So yes, he was obviously part of the Reformed tradition.
So he was a Lutheran, and he was going to become. Mm-hmm. A priest in the Lutheran Church. He was going to have a good job. He's going to have a wife and two children, and he was going to retire comfortably.
Today, most people would think of going for priesthood or ordination as a bit of a way out idea, you know.
Right.
Whereas in that day and age, it was a perfectly kind of ordinary career choice.
Yeah, the priesthood in Denmark in the 19th century was very much like being a civil servant.
Right.
It was considered to be a wing of the state. Mm. You were employed by the government, and it was a job for life.
Yeah.
And Søren, basically, he took his Christianity so seriously that he realized that that life, he was going to be in a collision course with that kind of life. That if you started to focus on Jesus, and he realized, actually, Jesus, the kind of life lived in imitation of Jesus Christ, will often put you at odds with the kind of comfortable, civilized European life that he was living.
Yeah. There was a disconnect between what he saw.
So he called that Christendom. Mm. And he realized that, so it wasn't just the established church, wasn't just Christendom. It was the whole Christian culture, or Christianized culture. And he said, he ended up saying that Christendom has done away with Christianity. So in an age where becoming a Christian is as easy as being born, he said,
right,
I need to make Christianity harder.
That's kind of interesting, because it almost goes against the modern push towards let's make it as...
Yeah.
Make our churches seeker-friendly and
yes.
try and make sure it's as easy as pie to kind of become a Christian. He, in a sense,
well, you can see the shades of cheap grace here. So Bonhoeffer said, when Jesus bids a man come, he bids him come and die. And that's a very Kierkegaardian kind of idea, is that actually to follow Jesus means to say no to some of the things that we naturally put our allegiance or our safety in. So our nationality or our social class or something like that.
I mean, was he essentially worried that Christianity was becoming, in that sense, nominal? It was something you were born into rather than something you embraced for yourself.
Yeah, and this is a particular problem with Christendom. Mm. That Christendom has invented the problem of nominal Christians. Because before Christendom existed, you would say, where are the Christians? Oh, the Christian was very easy to spot.
Yes.
Because they were the ones meeting together on a Sunday morning, you know, in the corner house. And they lived very differently. But in Christendom, spotting a real Christian has become all of a sudden become a problem. Like even the word, what is a real Christian? I mean, there's three of us in this room, and if I asked you what a real Christian is, we might have three different answers. And that's a problem of Christendom that we can't tell that anymore.
Do you think we're still living in Christendom, Jane, or are we in a post-Christendom? Some people call us a post-Christendom society now.
Yes, I think we probably are post-Christendom, but... but with a lot of the benefits of Christendom. Mm. So one of the reasons, arguably, that we can't tell who the Christians are anymore is that Christians have been able to help influence our whole Western civilization. Mm. So that the fact that children have free education, the fact that old people are cared for, all of that comes out of Christendom. It comes out of a Christian understanding of what a good society looks like. And yes, it has the downside of, therefore, Christians aren't this small, distinctive outsider group. But on the other hand, it has the upside that huge numbers of people have
the benefits of Christendom.
Exactly.
Yes. Is it always the case, though, that if you like, Christianity becomes the dominant cultural idea, that it's almost impossible to stop it sliding into a kind of a nominal form of Christianity because as people become then born Christian in that sense?
Well, I mean, I suspect that you can make this too much of a dividing line kind of thing. I suspect there were always nominal Christians, even in the very earliest church, there were people whose friends were Christians, and they thought, okay, well, that looks nice, mm-hmm. I'll stick with my friends.
Well, Soren said it didn't start with Constantine. It started in the Book of Acts when 5,000 were added to their number in one day. And he said, surely there must have been one or two people that just looked around and went, well, if everyone else is doing it, I will too.
And it's easy to despise that. But on the other hand, it's one of the issues that I do take a little with Kirkwood is this sort of unremitting judgmental attitude to whether or not people are really Christians.
Right.
Augustine and others of the great church fathers said it's actually quite important for us to remember only God knows who's a Christian.
Mm.
And the fact that Kierkegaard, for example, liked his Christianity to be miserable doesn't necessarily make it true.
Is that true, Stephen? I mean, you're painting him as a bit of a miserable old character.
Well, there's something to that, I suppose. He was...
Tell us the titles of some of his books, for example.
Yes. I mean, Fear and Trembling, The Concept of Anxiety.
Wow.
Sickness unto death.
Yes.
All top sellers in today's well-being.
I would like to defend. I've got a couple of degrees in philosophy, and I can tell you, absolutely, there's more laughs in Kierkegaard than in any other philosopher. He was also very funny. He was also quite... witty and satirical. He had a huge sort of passionate sort of loving side to him, and he wrote sort of prose poems of worship. He's not all miserable, but he does take life seriously. He does look at things that we might take for granted, and he wants to pause and look at it carefully.
How is he regarded by his fellow countrymen, and particularly people in the church?
Well, at his here's a clue. At his funeral, there was a riot because he was being buried. His family had him buried in the church, in the great sort of central, the Church of Our Lady in Copenhagen, which is the kind of cathedral of Copenhagen. And there was a riot because some of his supporters said this man was so against Christendom that it's a dishonor to his memory to bury him in a church.
Really?
And then other people in the church were saying, it's a dishonor to bury him in the church because he was so mean to us and he didn't like us at all. So, I mean, I can't imagine today a theological writer causing a riot at his or her funeral. So he was infamous in his lifetime. Mm. He wasn't necessarily a success. And in fact, he didn't. None of his books were translated outside of Danish until almost a century after he died. So he wasn't like a
was he sort of seen
success.
As the bad boy of theology in his day, kind of?
Yeah. Well, he didn't. He picked fights with people, so he didn't suffer fools gladly. So when he thought that people were being a bit fatuous or using their church position in order to just make their lives more comfortable, he called them out on it. He wrote about them by name, which was quite an offensive thing to do.
Was he ever married?
No. Well, this is part of his story. So he became engaged when he was 24. I think he became engaged to an 18-year-old named Regine Olsen, who was, by all accounts, lovely. I've got a bit of a literary crush on Regine. My wife, she allows this.
Okay.
And she was this sweet, intelligent, witty girl, and everybody loved her. And Soren fell in love with her as well, and they were kind of an intellectual equals.
Mm.
And after a courtship of about 2 years, he arranged to break it off because he realized that his life was so... kind of serious and was, he sort of thought of his life as a bit of a curse on her. He didn't want to curse her by bringing her into his life.
He knew that the path he had chosen was going to bring
a bit of a clash. He knew in a kind of a vocation, he said it was almost like his vocation was going to be in a clash with some of these very things that married life was supposed to endorse.
Mm.
And so he didn't want to sort of impose that on her. And so but to break up with a young woman in that society would have brought dishonor on her. People would have assumed that there was something wrong with her.
Right.
So what he did was he very kind of deliberately cultivated an appearance of being a cad about town. He sort of made himself look...
like something out of a Jane Austen novel or something.
Yes, it is, actually.
It?
He made himself look a bit dishonorable. He very deliberately sort of stood her up in public. He took with her to a play and then stood up in the middle and walked out on her. So that she would break up with him and society wouldn't think that she was the problem.
How extraordinary.
Doesn't sound like much fun for her, Stephen.
No.
And we have from his journals that he thought his scheme was working, right?
Right.
We have from her memoirs that they didn't.
Oh, she saw through it.
And she allowed him to kind of have his way.
Yeah.
And she never stopped loving him. She did get married again, but she always spoke highly of Soren for the rest of her life.
I mean, I've got to say, he may have been theologically brilliant, but I wonder whether in personal terms he was also a little bit of a klutz. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it just strikes me that maybe they could have worked it out. I don't know, but who knows? What do you think, Jane?
Well, it sounds to me as though she was actually better off without him. but again, there is this aspect, Kierkegaard, which he sort of seems to have seen himself as a sort of outsider kind of hero.
Mm.
And the sense that there is almost a kind of selfishness about that, that he may have seen that as his overriding vocation. But you sort of think, well, you could actually have put down some of the things that you were so passionate about in order to be more accommodating to others.
Is Kierkegaard a bit like one of those sometimes Christians I meet who are incredibly passionate and oriented towards all the right things, but they're almost... It's all they ever go on about, and I always feel a bit like I'm not doing enough compared to them because
right.
they're so committed. They're so,
right.
you know, you've got to live this lifestyle and you've got to do this. And I think, well, sometimes I just want to sit and watch EastEnders, to be honest, you know.
This is why I wrote the biography, though, Justin, because the books Kierkegaard writes are all, you know, one of his best books is called For Self-Examination, which sounds very clinical, but it's all about, you know, if you call yourself a Christian, then you need to examine yourself. And it's a beautiful book and it's really challenging, but his books are one side of him, but his life was different. I mean, he doted on his nephews and nieces. He had a big family. Mm. He had friends that he went for walks constantly. He knew everybody. He was, like I said, an upper middle class man, but he very deliberately became friends with fishwives and shoeshine boys, and the king of Denmark liked him. So he spanned all different groups, and he loved people. He was not a misanthrope at all. His books seem very judgmental and harsh, but that's only one side of him. He was sort of... That was a deliberate voice he was taking in order to prod you.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll continue talking about Kierkegaard. Today on the programme, I'm joined by Stephen Backhouse and Jane Williams. Stephen is the author of a new book on the life of Kierkegaard. It's called Kierkegaard, A Single Life. And you can find out more about it from the website. I'll put links there to both Stephen and Jane. And we're going to continue talking about the established church. That was something that Kierkegaard came into conflict with during the course of his life. And just how his theology has continued to touch us today. So come back for another part of Unbelievable, the second part, in just a moment's time with me, Justin Brierley. 40 years ago, four teenagers met in a kitchen in Dublin and decided to form a band. Since then, U2 have conquered the rock world and never been afraid to sing about God while doing so. In the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine, we chart their four-decade spiritual journey and the impact they've had on the global church. Plus, we talk to Eric Metaxas on why he's backing Trump. We explore the rise of the true crime documentary and find new ways to pray. All that plus much more. Make sure you pick up a free sample copy at premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of today's programme. Got a theological edition of Unbelievable for you today as we look at a particular character. Now, we don't often do this, but it's quite fun to do it, I'm finding. In fact, Soren Kierkegaard, or Kierkegaard, there are different ways to pronounce it, is our subject under discussion today. Who was he and what did he do for modern theology? Well, we're hoping that by the end of today's programme, you'll know a lot more about him. Stephen Backhouse is lecturer in social and political theology at St. Miletus College. He's the author of a new book, Kierkegaard, A Single Life, available from kierkegaardbook.com. And Jane Williams, also with us in studio, Assistant Dean and Lecturer in Systematic Theology at St. Miletus. StMiletus.org if you want to find out more about what they do. Jane also hosts GodPod as well. Don't forget that if you're listening and you'd like to contribute to today's programme, I always welcome your emails, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. I try to read as many out at the end of a programme as I can, so do send them in. And don't forget that straight after today's edition of Unbelievable, you can hear The Profile. You'll be hearing another high-profile Christian talking about their walk of faith and life. So that's between 4 and 5 this Saturday afternoon. If you enjoy Unbelievable, you enjoy these kinds of discussions, why not check out our back catalogue as well? Loads of interesting discussions between people. Today's is a very friendly conversation. Sometimes it's a bit more combative as well, as we have atheists and Christians doing battle. But if you want to see the back catalogue, go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And why not subscribe to the podcast if that's your sort of thing? Well, coming back to both of you, Stephen and Jane, I'm really enjoying hearing about Kierkegaard's life. I suppose, though, we should move into talking a little bit about the things that have been significant, though, when it comes to his theology. He was quite an intense character, and he saw Christianity as something you really had to own and live. He was against this sort of nominal kind of Christianity he saw. And in some ways, I totally feel that myself. I think we kind of, today, to call yourself a Christian means you're actually saying something quite significant, whereas perhaps 50, 60 years ago in our country, there might have been a more of a what Kierkegaard would have recognised as a nominal sense. And I think we're seeing that in things like when people no longer decide to tick Christian or CRV or whatever in the census statistics. Some people say, oh, shows that Christianity is falling off. I wonder whether it's more just people choosing not to sort of go with the cultural norms that have been established. I don't know what your opinion is on all of that, Jane.
Yes, no, I think that's right. I think you don't call yourself a Christian now unless you think of yourself as a Christian. So it isn't just C of E like NHS or... So in that sense, I think it's actually a very good thing.
Is Kierkegaard at any level responsible for us, I suppose, in, you know, post-Christendom, reclaiming a kind of a sense of, no, if you are Christian, then you really believe it, you really sort of have something, you look distinctive from the rest of culture?
No, I don't think so.
You don't think so?
I think I think there are all kinds of other issues to do with materialism, individualism and so on, some of which you can trace to Kierkegaard and his influence, but I think the decline in nominal Christianity has other roots entirely.
Okay, when it comes to the established church, he got the backs up of quite a few people. We've already been hearing, Stephen. Did he sort of want to see the church disestablished from the state? That was obviously the way it ran at that time in Denmark. Was that what he was after?
Well, a little bit like Wesley and the Methodists, he didn't set out to be separate from the established church. It kind of became that. So for a lot of his writing career, he wrote for the bishop, who was the old bishop, Münster, was a friend of his, and the bishop of Denmark. And he wrote for him and wanted him to kind of start to walk the talk, as it were. And when Münster declined to engage with it, can you imagine the Bishop of Denmark not agreeing with somebody who said that he's responsible for destroying Christianity in Denmark? When he didn't really agree with this and stayed silent on it, that's when Kierkegaard actually kind of went dialed it up to 11,
right,
as it were, and became much more overtly disestablishment and anti-Christendom. Right. But it wasn't his original intent. I mean, he always thought the church could admit that it had made a mistake and wasn't doing a very good job of being Christian, and it could be Christian again. Even if it was,
I mean, how did he want to make it, in that sense, harder to become a Christian in his society?
Well, the problem with Christendom for him was the problem of, I guess, what we might call triumphalism, or the idea that you look around and you say, oh, well, Jesus obviously was God because look at all the people who have called themselves Christian for the last 2,000 years. Mm. Or look at all the buildings we have, or look at how many years Christianity has survived. It must be true. And Kierkegaard looked at that and he said, all you're doing is you're just substituting the quantity for the quality. So you're just looking at the amount of years or people or buildings or books, and you're saying that is evidence for the truth. And he said, what we need to do is go back. This is where the leap idea came from, in a way. We need to leap kind of across all that baggage of Christendom, the accumulated numbers of things, and go stand right before Jesus, or live, he said, in contemporaneity with Jesus, in a contemporary position with him, where all of a sudden it becomes not so obvious that he's God, or that he's the leader of a successful cultural movement. He's in fact a guy with a bit of fish in his beard who says, "Come to me all who are weary and I will give you rest." And in that moment, you have to choose to be offended by Jesus or to follow him and believe him. And so Kierkegaard said, you know, faith only exists when you are in that position where you might potentially be offended by Jesus.
Mm.
And if you've never been introduced to a Jesus that is potentially offensive, you can never be said to have faith in him.
Mm.
Because otherwise you're just joining a successful group or something like that.
What do you think of all this, Jane? Is there any value in the, I suppose, the edifice of the church that has developed over the course of millennia? And what, obviously it looks very different to the man with the fisherman friends and the fish in his beard and so on. But is there still something that is of value that Kierkegaard overlooked?
Well, of course, what Kierkegaard very typically was focusing on was the offensive Jesus.
Hmm.
But on the whole, the people who were offended by Jesus were the people who were in power of one kind or another. And it's easy to forget all the women and children who flocked because he was kind to them and fed them, mm-hmm. and healed them. And was not at all offensive to them. And that's partly why Christianity has actually grown, is that ordinary people find it a faith where there is room for them. And so, you know, the fact that there are huge numbers of Christians and with beautiful buildings and so on is a tribute to the good news, the gospel of Jesus Christ, that invites people to come and find rest, not be offended necessarily. And and clearly, there are people who should be offended by Jesus. But I think one of the things that I find Kierkegaard doesn't really address enough is just this sense that actually God is the creator of all, who longs to redeem all, who loves all, and Kierkegaard setting this up, this picture of the sort of lonely, the only true Christian
is against the world.
Yes, yeah. I can't see why that's gospel. I can't see why that's good news for the kind of people who flocked to hear the love of God in Jesus Christ.
I mean, do you get the sense from your reading of Kierkegaard then, Jane, that he sort of was a little bit, if you're not kind of feeling a bit out at the outsider and against the state and all of the rest of it, you're not really a Christian if you're sort of too comfortable, if you're sort of quite happy with life in that sense?
I mean, that does seem to me what he was saying. And I do see some force in it, but I think you can really overdo it so that it becomes another kind of romanticism. And I think if you look at some of the great theologians of the church, people like Augustine, sorry, you always get Augustine if I'm talking. he was always up against people who said, there's only one pure church and it's the one that we belong to. There's only one kind of right Christian and that's me. And Augustine was always saying, you have to remember that the church is like a hospital for the sick. It's where people who are in need come.
Yeah.
You don't have to be perfect before you come. You come as you are, and God works with you.
Yeah.
And so any model of the church that suggests, first of all, I have to get myself straight before I can come to God, it doesn't seem to me to be a helpful or truthful one.
Yeah.
I mean, how far do you think he was right about, I guess, his antipathy towards the established church by the end of his life, Stephen?
Well, I think on the whole, I have to say, I think he probably went more right more often.
Mm-hmm.
In that he I think he really did pinpoint an actual problem with the Christianity that was represented to European, well, to any cultural Christian place, including ours. We're a post-Christian Christendom, to be totally specific, even in this country, in the UK. And I think there is something to be said for looking at what kind of Christianity do people think they're getting within Christendom? And then how do we reintroduce Christianity into Christendom? I think there's something to be said for what he does there. And he does highlight, he sees Christendom not necessarily as this evil that must be destroyed, but more like a temptation to guard against. And most Christians probably don't think of Christendom as a temptation to guard against. They probably think of it as either a thing in the history or a goal that they want to make Britain Christian again or something like that. And he says maybe that's not so good for Christianity.
What would this look like specifically? I mean, what kind of issues was he concerned about that the church wasn't, I don't know, representing Jesus and the gospel in the right way because they were this sort of too comfortable established organisation?
It was mostly honesty. I mean, I can totally hear what Jane, her criticism of Kierkegaard, and I can really understand that. I think he would be sad to hear this because he himself worked really hard to not make himself the model of Christianity. He also said, look, I also don't meet this standard. Right. I am not the good Christian judging everyone else. I am on the side of also having to examine myself. And he really tried to not be a reformer or anything like that. And in fact, he even said, it's not Christianity that I'm venturing for. Christianity can take care of itself. It's honesty. So I would rather people honestly know what Christianity is and reject it than not know what it is and think they are one. So he was more interested in just saying, all right, you call yourself a Christian, here's what it is. Now, do you really still call yourself a Christian? And if you were to say no, he would actually say, okay, my job is done. So he wasn't trying to convert everyone to his brand of Christianity. He was just trying to say the New Testament, what the New Testament meant by being a follower of Christ is not what anybody I've ever met thinks it is. And I just want to highlight the difference.
Would I suppose, Kierkegaard have disapproved then of the person who maybe comes along to their local Anglican church, Jane, and says, well, I want to get married here and I want to have my child here and I want to turn up at Easter and Christmas and I want it to sort of be in the background of my life. But they're not the kind of person who's saying, I'm going to go and be a missionary and do this and do that or anything else. I mean, and do you have a problem yourself with that person or not? Or is that actually, that's the way some people will engage with church and that's okay?
I tend to want people to engage with God wherever they can. I'm not very fussy about where people start because I think God can do extraordinary things. So people may come along to church for, you know, what we might think of as the wrong reasons. But if it gives them a chance to encounter God, God can do anything. And maybe I am being unfair to Kierkegaard because obviously what you read is the things that people write are not necessarily the whole of their lives. So I'd love to hear Stephen say, you know, what would Kierkegaard have said about the gospel to the fishwives that you say he was kind to and people like that? Would he have said to them, you have to stop and examine whether you're being truly honest and Christian? Or would he have said, you're fine, come close? I mean, because there may be a difference between a sort of the fighting position that's for publication and a lived position in relation to other people.
I mean, it was, he literally had she wasn't a fishwife, she was a innkeeper. And he wrote a lot of his stuff for her. Her name was also Regine, but he didn't have a love affair with her. And she was a borderline illiterate innkeeper, and he wrote things. So he has a reputation for being difficult, but that's part of his, he does it on purpose, right? He says, I want to make Christianity more difficult for those who think that they're already Christians. But when he wants to be accessible, he can be as well.
Right.
And he would write, near the end of his life, he wrote a lot of sort of newspaper-type articles and things, which this Regine, the innkeeper, read and enjoyed. And she was almost his ideal reader in some ways. And he was, one of his things was, the problem with the kind of cultured, sophisticated Christianity that's being offered to the masses is it requires you to have a degree in Latin and Hebrew and to know Greek poetry and to be a sophisticated elite in order to call yourself a Christian. It had been so associated with civilization that, in fact, the fishwives and the innkeepers were the very ones being denied.
They thought they didn't have any stake in it.
It was irrelevant to them. And he really always came back to, he was very Christocentric. He was always like, well, Jesus said, come to me, all who are weary. And the problem is the Christianity being offered to people is one of being a good Danish cultured citizen. It's not one of bring your burdens to Jesus. So, I mean, he was trying. I think he overestimated our ability to understand him, but he was trying.
And how much is it fair to say that he's so concentrated on self-examination, whether or not I've got it right, that he really did discount how much we are here just to help each other muddle along and get as close to God as we can by kindness to each other? I mean, how much did he actually discount sort of community?
Well, he did. So even within his lifetime, people were saying this about him. They're saying, you're just too individualistic, you're too isolated from other people, you don't know anything about human love. So he very deliberately went and wrote a book called Works of Love, which was a really long reflection on love thy neighbour, the command to love your neighbour. And he really tried to find a way that you could think of yourself as... one of the problems with Christendom is that it so identifies your identity with your nationality. So you are primarily a Dane or a Brit or a Scots or whatever. You're primarily a, you know, Nigerian, whatever it is. And he's saying, no, you're primarily a human being who exists in the eye of God. And all the other things kind of come on top of that. And so he kind of drew a wedge between the idea of a neighborhood and a nationhood.
Mm.
The idea that Jesus said, love your neighbor, not love your nation.
Yes.
And that in fact, in love your neighbor commands from the New Testament, the neighbor is defined explicitly against your co-nationality, your compatriot, right? And he said there's something really important about seeing everybody you meet as your neighbor before you see them as your co-national or even as your family member. Mm. So he was trying to find a way to focus on every individual exists in the eye of God, and we're all supposed to love each other without being tribal. So he's trying to break away from that tribalism, the idea that I'm only going to love people who look like me and sound like me as much as possible.
Okay.
He did try.
Can we talk about this idea of the leap of faith? People often talk about a leap of faith. I don't know if it's a helpful concept sometimes, because I think, especially when I've often spoken to agnostics, atheists, skeptics, they see that as that's the problem with Christianity, to some extent. You're taking a leap into the dark. You're going against the evidence. You're sort of saying, I'm going to just sort of go for it. And I've heard other people say, well, faith is often being kind of misinterpreted in that sense. It should be seen as trust. And you trust things because you've got evidence for them. And, you know, you feel you've got good reason to trust this Jesus Christ. You've got good reason and so on. So what did he mean by a leap of faith when it came to Christianity?
Well, he never used that phrase famously. So that's an English... That was... Some of his English translators used that phrase as a way to sum up what they thought he was trying to say. So it's because of him that we have the phrase, but he never used it.
Okay.
He did talk about leaping and faith a lot. But one of the things about Kierkegaard we haven't mentioned yet is most of his writing was done under pseudonyms. And he was very deliberately trying to... So his pseudonyms didn't represent... He wasn't trying to hide his identity. They represented characters in the stage of Christendom. And different pseudonyms represent different ways of people who think they know what Christianity is about.
Okay.
So some of the more... So this book called Fear and Trembling, which is a famous Kierkegaard book, which a lot of people would have maybe encountered, you know, as first-year undergraduates or something. This is where we get the idea of the leap of faith from, really. And the pseudonym, whose name is Johannes de Silentio, John the Silent One, he tells you, I am not a Christian. I do not have faith, but I think faith looks like this. And then he tells the story of Abraham and Isaac. And he says Abraham took a blind leap into the dark. He was told by God to kill his son, and he just did it against all reason, right? And De Silentio says, if that's what faith must be, it's awful. It's dark and awful.
Mm.
Now, that is a dark and awful view of faith. The problem is Kierkegaard wanted you to think that it was a dark and awful view of faith, because he didn't want you to just read Fear and Trembling and then go away. He wanted you to pick up that book and go, oh, I wonder, is that really what faith is? I wonder if anybody else has written anything else about faith. And you'd sit down and you'd pick up another book by Johannes Climacus, John the Climber, which was published the same day.
Right.
And that has a totally different view of faith, right? So
interesting.
He's trying to have a conversation. He's trying to make Christianity more hard rather than easy. He's saying it's not as easy as just following one person's kind of one fabulous speaker's line. Yeah. You have to work it out for yourself. Is this what you think faith is? And by the end of his life, as Kierkegaard becomes more Christian, he starts losing the pseudonyms and he starts speaking in his own voice. And you start to notice that faith for him is not about this blind leap.
Mm.
It is much more about, as you said, following a person.
Right.
So it's significant that in the Fear and Trembling, the name Jesus Christ never gets mentioned. By the end of his life, Kierkegaard never stops talking about Jesus Christ by name. And that's very significant.
Yeah. What do you think of the concept of a leap of faith? Is that something that's generally in the consciousness of people today, that to be a Christian requires a so-called leap of faith, Jane?
Yes, I think so. And I think probably for quite good reasons, because you can't argue towards. I mean, you can argue that there are good grounds for believing in God, and you can argue there's a lot of evidence and good suggestions for believing in God, but you can't actually deduce the existence of God.
Sure.
You can't for good reasons, because if you could deduce the existence of God, then God would be an object in the universe.
Yeah. Mm.
And God is not an object in the universe. God is the source of all.
Mm.
So in that sense, there comes a point beyond which human reason will not get you.
Yeah.
And you have to step out and say, I will trust this.
Yeah.
And the thing is, we make it as though this is the only place we do this is in faith. But actually, when you get married, you take a leap of faith.
Mm-hmm.
You trust that this person is somebody that you will want to spend your life with, that they are to be trusted with all your happiness, despite the fact there's a lot of evidence around in the society around us that marriage might not make you happy.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Each of us makes that what you might call a leap of faith. So we do it in all kinds of situations. We go beyond where evidence can absolutely us in order to trust something bigger. And I do think that is an important concept. I think I think Kierkegaard's example of Abraham was a very interesting one. He sees Abraham as a kind of great hero of the faith, partly because Abraham is prepared to do what looks like something immoral.
Mm.
He's prepared not just to follow society's morals, which say, obviously, you don't kill your son.
Mm.
He's prepared to say, if God really exists and God is really telling me to do this, then it's more important than anything else.
Mm.
Now, as you know, that particular story of Abraham being asked to sacrifice Isaac has a happy ending. God does not require Abraham to do that.
Mm.
But he does require Abraham to know that God is more important than anything else. And that, I think, it's interesting that that's not in Kierkegaard's own voice, but it is an important point that Kierkegaard is making, is that if there is a God, then God has to be worth more than anything else. And you have to know that with your life and with your decisions.
I suppose this is when he talks about faith. It's this sense of faith about, well, you can be a happy Christian born into a Christian nation, but faith, that's not really faith. That's just the happenstance of your circumstance.
That's just being part of a group. Yeah.
Faith is actually choosing to do something because of your belief in Jesus Christ or God,
that wouldn't
make much sense otherwise.
In
that sense, it will often go against our natural instincts.
Yeah, so faith for Kierkegaard, the opposite of faith is not reason for Kierkegaard. It was, back to this word, offence. So it's almost a more of a moral thing. So it's not, the opposite of faith is not, I've used my brain to work out reasonably that Jesus is God.
Mm.
It's more, this guy has asked me, do you believe in me?
Mm.
And I now have a choice that I'm going to turn away in disgust, or I'm going to follow.
I've always felt the same, that faith isn't the bit where you say, I've rationally concluded that Jesus is God's son. It's the bit where you say, and I'm prepared to stake my life on it.
Yeah, and I think that's...
in some way.
So I think Kierkegaard's good for... He helps give us language to discuss what's going on. There's different types of faith, or there's different things people think they're doing when they have faith. And he falls on the side of faith as almost a moral, emotional response to a thing, rather than an intellectual, rational response to a thing.
Yeah. I guess in the period he was writing in, it was the Enlightenment and so on and all of that. Was he kind of pressing back against a kind of that rationalistic kind of view of the world and science and saying, actually, we need to...
Well, can I drop an H-bomb on you? It was Hegel.
Okay.
The philosopher Hegel. And Hegel was the main guy that Kierkegaard was writing against. And we're all very influenced by Hegel, whether we know it or not. So if you believe in the myth of progress at all, if you think that what we're doing now is better than what was being done then, we know more about the world now than 2,000 years ago or 50 years ago.
Yes.
Or as G.K. Chesterton said, the myth of progress is that Wednesday is better than Tuesday. that's Hegel. He was very much in the idea that God's revelation is in the history of the world. God is best expressed in whatever man has most recently come up with.
Right.
And you see this in all sorts of things. I mean, you see this in obviously it fed into sort of German nationalism, but you also see it in kind of the American exceptionalism, the idea of the manifest destiny. You know, God has given us this nation to take over. Every every kind of Christianized empire that's ever existed has always had a sense that God has put us in history. History has led to us.
Right.
We are God's
truth to the world. We're the pinnacle.
And Kierkegaard said, no.
Okay.
Jesus is God's truth to the world, and that was 2,000 years ago.
Mm.
And we always have to keep circling back to that.
Yeah.
So so there was a sense that it was actually Hegel that he was trying against.
So does that make him a bit passive? Does that mean that Christians, what we have to do is we have to sit in our studies and trust Jesus and not do anything?
Yeah, I know. The idea of a Kierkegaardian politics is an interesting one. What do you do with it? For sure. Yeah, for sure. He was so focused on your individual response to Jesus that the sense of his kind of wider community organizing and movement is lacking.
So if we only had Kierkegaard, would we have any Christians at all? if Kierkegaard had won and demolished the church, would we be even in as good a position as we are now, or would the whole thing have
come apart? Well, that's a really good question. I mean, there is no Kierkegaardian church, that's for sure. And Karl Barth, the great Protestant theologian Karl Barth, who was very influenced by Kierkegaard, he said, everyone should go to the school of Kierkegaard, but they shouldn't stay there. Which I think is fair enough.
They need to graduate.
Yeah. Kierkegaard is more like pepper
on
your spaghetti bolognese.
He's not the main ingredient. You
wouldn't want only pepper, but you need something that makes you sneeze every once in a while to remind you of the other things going on.
That's a very good analogy. We're going to have to take another quick break, and we'll be finishing this conversation in a moment's time. Søren Kierkegaard is our subject under discussion. Who was he? What did he do for modern theology? Stephen Backhouse and Jane Williams with me for today's edition of Unbelievable. We'll be back in just a moment's time.
In July 2016, Unbelievable, the conference, took place in London, a day for any Christian who struggles to share their faith with others.
I'm Justin Brierley, and I hosted a fantastic day of inspirational sessions with J. John, Gary Habermas, Beth Grove, and many others.
Now you've got the chance to watch and listen to over 12 hours of this empowering conference,
featuring evangelism, apologetics, and the resurrection.
Get your DVD at premier.org.uk/shop and become a confident evangelist today.
Welcome back to the final part of today's Unbelievable. And I don't know whether, like me, you were sort of a bit frazzled and brain-boggled and mind-bended by last week's programme, which was, of course, an edition on the multiverse, in which I was joined by Jeff Swearink and Skydive Phil, both who actually more or less saw things the same way as far as the evidence for the multiverse is concerned, and whether it is a challenge to fine-tuning of the universe for life as it's traditionally envisioned. Well, lots of response to that. I'm going to save it up for a future edition of the programme, because we're going to do the multiverse again next week, in fact. Yes, we're having another stab at what is, frankly, a really technical subject. And so I hope, well, if you thought last week was pretty technical and hard to get your head around, That was just the starter. Okay, what we're doing next week is gonna up the ante. So if you want to come back for that, that's going to be between someone who has been recommended to me by lots of people and I've wanted to have on the show for a while, Luke Barnes. He is coming out with a new book on fine-tuning, the evidence for fine-tuning. And he is more sceptical of multiverse as an answer to fine-tuning, as a theory in itself. So he'll be in conversation. He's a physicist from Australia. In conversation with Max Andrews next week. Max is a young philosopher who is currently doing PhD research in the area of multiverse, many worlds, fine-tuning, that kind of thing. So that's going to be a fascinating conversation as we do round two of the multiverse and fine-tuning fights back, as it were, on next week's programme. Look forward to you joining me for that. We've got some of your feedback coming up. Still trying to chug through a lot of the feedback to shows that were broadcast over the summer. Also, after we've concluded our conversation on today's show, going to be hearing from Chris Date and John Tancock about the upcoming Rethinking Hell conference happening Friday the 7th, Saturday the 8th of October. I'm going to be hosting the Saturday of that conference. I hope you can come along if you're interested in those kinds of theological issues. It's an unmissable conference, really. And if I may, can I remind you that Unbelievable is part of Faith Explored every week here on Premier Christian Radio, brought to you in association with the magazine I edit, Premier Christianity Magazine, our brand new October edition, already available. You can ask for a free sample copy, very special feature on the front cover on U2 at 40. I realised about a year ago that at the end of September 2016, it would be 40 years since U2 formed in
the end of September 1976. And so we've written about that. We've written about 40 years of their faith-fueled music, St. Bono and his band, how they became icons of rock by singing about God. Do go to the website if you want to get a free sample copy of the latest mag, and a great front cover on it as well. That's premierchristianity.com/free sample. Okay, time to finish up today's conversation.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, concluding today's programme, we've been talking about Soren Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard? Well, there are different ways to pronounce it. My guests today on Unbelievable have been Stephen Backhouse and Jane Williams. And Stephen, lecturer in social and political theology at St. Miletus College in London. Jane is the assistant dean there as well. The book we've been talking about is Kierkegaard, A Single Life. Now, I've been mentioning it's available. You can find out more at kierkegaardbook.com. Don't want to make that sound like it's a self-published thing. This is actually Zondervan, the publisher who are behind this book, Stephen. And so I'm sure it's available via Amazon and all the rest of it too. Yeah. The title is slightly intriguing. Kierkegaard, A Single Life. Is that a reference to the fact he was a single man, romantically?
Yeah, it definitely is. I find that a very fascinating and sad and sweet part of his life. And also, he emphasized, I mean, everything he wrote, he often dedicated to the single individual. He dedicated it. Mm. And he was sort of thinking of Regine, his fiancée, and he was also thinking of anyone who was going to read his book, yeah. The single individual. And also, it's a bit of a irony because he used so many pseudonyms and he spoke with so many different voices that I thought it
lots
was
just, of individuals.
It just seemed a fun little title.
But in general, the important point is that he did sort of want people to get back to the individualism in that sense of Christianity. He felt like that there was a danger in kind of just being part of the mass, the church, sort of seeing, not kind of embracing for yourself individually who Christ is.
Yeah, he was an individualist. That is definitely true, and he did emphasize individualism. Probably
now that's often now seen as a bad thing. Individualism in the church, you know, oh, it's just about me and my relationship with God, and you know, it doesn't really matter what else happens. So has there been a pushback? Would you say, Jane, to Kierkegaard's individualism in the church today?
I think we definitely need a pushback. I don't think there's been enough of a pushback. I think there is still. Almost too much of a sense that it's all about me and me being right with God. And that leaves out the fact that God created the whole world, loves it, and wills to redeem it and fulfil it.
And that's a communal activity.
That is a communal activity. Mm. And so the minute that you become a Christian, you become friends with the people that God is friends with. And so you can't, you have to be part of the group of people that God has called to be his disciples, to be the disciples of Christ. And that's something that a lot of us really don't like. A lot of us feel we could be really wonderful Christians if only we didn't have to bother with all those other idiots. And when I say it like that, you can see where the flaw is, can't you? That it becomes a kind of arrogance that doesn't acknowledge that this is not just a project about me and saving me. This is a project about the whole of creation.
Do you feel like you would have gotten on well with Kierkegaard yourself, Stephen?
Oh boy, I never thought of that before, actually.
Well, having sort of invested so much time into kind of finding out about him, knowing what he was like, I guess you get a sense of his character.
I liked him.
In all of
I
that.
Did like him. I mean, he's ornery and he's miserable sometimes, but he's also funny and sad, and he's enthusiastic teenager who got infatuated with people, and he was he enjoyed the theatre, and I don't know, I found lots of things about him that I kind of resonated with. He wrote lots of journals. He was a deeply kind of introspective guy, so I feel like he wasn't unaware of himself, and he did find interest in lots of other people, so I would hope he'd find interest in me, but we'll see.
Thank you very much for coming in as well, Jane, to be the foil for Stephen today. Just quickly worth mentioning that I'll put a link to the premier lecture which you delivered back in June for our station as well. So if you want to find out more about that, Jane delivered a fascinating talk on 21st century Christians, but drawing on
first century Christians
in a 21st century world. Yeah. That was the one. If you want more from Stephen as well, he's going to be featuring shortly in the forthcoming edition of Premier Christianity magazine as well. A short take on the life of Kierkegaard in our 10-minute theologian column. So lots of ways to read up more about that. All the links available from today's programme. That's at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And I wish you all the very best for the book, Steve, and I hope it does make a lot more people a bit more aware of I'm certainly a lot more aware myself than I was an hour ago of Mr. Kierkegaard, however you pronounce his name.
There's lots of funny things in his life. It's not all doom and gloom.
Absolutely. All the very best, and all the best at St. Melitus as well.
Thank you very much.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
If you want to get in touch about anything you've heard on the show, your responses to Søren Kierkegaard and his philosophy, unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the email address. You can find us online at UnbelievableJB, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the social media ways to get in touch. And of course, all those addresses, today's show, the podcast and much more available from the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Do leave me a comment there as well if you'd like to. We're going to be hearing about this forthcoming Rethinking Hell conference in a minute. But before we get to that, Kevin has emailed in because he heard me announced last week about Stephen and Jane coming on the show to talk about Kierkegaard, and he emailed in this fascinating thing to say, Stephen and I used to live two houses apart when we were growing up in Three Hills. Stephen and his brother David were preferential playmates as they had all the cool toys like Transformers and G.I. Joes, which we would use to stage battles in dirt piles and such. Unfortunately, all of our houses have since been demolished, so no future shrine is likely. I found GodPod when I did a Google search a couple of years ago, and he pops up on it. You go on to give a bit of detail about childhood memories of Stephen and his brother and so on, but you say it's particularly interesting that his book on Søren Kierkegaard is, as he is one of my favourite philosophers. Please say hello and congratulate Stephen from Kevin on his book and other accomplishments when you see him, and forward on this Google Drive link, which has some memories for him when he attended my brother's birthday party 30 years ago. Attached is a photo of the birthday from 1984, I think, with all the attendees labelled. You can test him by showing him the unlabeled version, see who he can name. I have certainly sent that on to Stephen, but thank you very much, Kevin. What a lovely little connection you've been able to let us know about. Some more of your feedback in just a moment's time. Joining me via the wonders of Skype now are JT, John Tancock and Chris Date, two of the people behind the Rethinking Hell Third International Conference. It's happening in London on October the 7th to the 8th at Highgate International Church. I'm going to be there myself hosting things on the Saturday of the conference. Perhaps you're interested in coming along. If you want to look into the current debate going on around hell, conditional immortality or annihilationism, as it's often called, this is a very important conference and coming for the first time to UK shores. So I've got two people with me to talk about it. JT, John Tancock and Chris Date. Chris, starting with you, welcome back to the programme. And I think the last time you were here, you were, of course, debating Al Mohler on this very subject. And that was a very popular program. But the conference you've been behind, and this the third one, and you're going to be hosting it here in the UK. Do you want to just very briefly outline what the conference is all about?
Sure, thanks for asking. So a growing number of conservative evangelicals are advocating an alternative to the traditional view of hell as eternal torment, an alternative that has sometimes gone by the label conditional immortality, which just means that the saved are the only people who will be granted immortality, and that in hell, the rest of the rest of mankind, the lost, they won't be made immortal and live forever in torment, but rather they'll be destroyed, they'll be executed. And so this is the third in a series of annual conferences that we at Rethinking Hell have been having, where we hope to introduce evangelicals in the UK that might not have already been familiar with this view. We want to introduce them to it and its biblical basis, because one thing that's really important to us at Rethinking Hell is that this is not the view of just liberals and people who deny what, you know, the authority of Scripture or anything like that. We are firmly committed to the authority of Scripture, to its infallibility, and we're confident that it teaches our view far more clearly than it has any support for the traditional view.
And your view is that more and more scholars and evangelicals generally are moving across to this point of view.
I believe so. I'm aware of a great number of people that, including myself, who held to the traditional view of eternal torment and then became a conditionalist. I'm aware of very, very few, if any, who have adopted our view and gone in the other direction.
Well, JT, you're the sort of British contingent in terms of the getting behind this particular conference, though there's a number of people from the UK who are contributing, I know. Did your views change over time on this particular issue?
Yes, I did. And I started to change when I was 18, and I'm actually 59 now, so it was quite a long time ago. But it was sparked off by a study that I did of the gospel messages in the book of Acts. And someone said, look, we should preach hell like they did in Acts. And you know something? I couldn't find hell in Acts. It's not mentioned. Eternal torment isn't mentioned. So that set me on a search. It took me a long time to arrive at the conclusion I have now.
Tell me a little bit, JT, about some of the people who are going to be presenting papers at this year's conference.
Okay, well, there's two I will mention. We've got David Instone Brewer, who is a little bit famous because, of course, he writes every month in Christianity magazine. He's a New Testament scholar, always gives a good background, detailed information. And he's one of the main speakers. And then the other speaker perhaps is better known. It's Roger Forster. Mm. And Roger Forster, of course, founded the Ichthus group of churches. And Roger has been a radical thinker for many, many years, but he's no liberal. He really does believe the Bible is the word of God. He's very evangelistic. So we're not talking about someone going soft on Christian truth here.
What kind of different aspects of this particular issue are going to be presented, Chris, across the course of the 2 days that you're holding this conference?
Yeah, well, the theme of this year's conference is conditional immortality, past, present, and future. And so I think that what you're going to get is a mix of presentations on the biblical basis for conditional immortality so that people that have become convinced of it know how they can make a compelling biblical case to a traditional evangelical audience. But also they'll hear something about the theological case for it, the philosophical case for it, an historical case, all of which will be designed to help people make a case that is persuasive to evangelicals in favor of this view, because of what we think is maybe the future that the evangelical church in the UK needs to go. You know, the numbers of people that are abandoning the church are high, and we think that one of the reasons why many people reject the faith is because the traditional view seems so inconsistent with what Christians claim to be the character of God. And so the future aspect of the theme of this year's conference, I think, will be really highlighted in the kinds of practical effects that adopting this biblical view, based on all the evidence that I just mentioned, the impact that will have in the culture as evangelicals try to take the gospel to the world.
Well, I'm really looking forward to being there myself and sharing time with you guys and the people who will be coming for this. And as I understand it, the Friday evening when things kick off between 7 and 9, that's actually free to attend. So people who want to find out what it's going to be like could go along then and then see if they want to pay for the following day. Is that right, Chris?
Yeah, that's right. So people will be able to come for free on Friday night and hear the message from Roger Forster. They'll hear a brief testimony from JT as well. And if they're intrigued, if they're interested and want to return the next day, they'll be able to register for the next day right then and there and come the next day where they'll get to hear from David Instone Brewer, from myself, and from a number of different breakout presenters that I think are going to have some very interesting things to say. And of course, best of all, they'll get to hear you host the conference since you're hosting it on Saturday.
No, I'm very much low down on this bill. But RethinkingHellConference.com is the website for people who want to find out more. I think it's very reasonably priced at £20 for attending this. And it's going to be at Highgate International Church. I mean, overall, JT, what's your hopes for what this begins or what this is contributing to in terms of what's going on in theological circles here in the UK?
OK, well, I hope that this conference will really push forward the whole idea that the view of hell, which is the traditional view, has less biblical support than the vast majority of people think. And what we're talking about in terms of conditional immortality really is rooted in so many different strands of biblical teaching. It is unfortunate, Justin, some Christians do feel that to even rethink the doctrine of hell is to reject a core doctrine of the faith. But of course, that isn't the case. It's not in the Evangelical Alliance Statement of Faith. It's not in the Worldwide Evangelical Alliance or even the Nicene Creed. So we are saying, look, rethink, be biblical, and you'll be surprised.
Great. Thank you very much both for joining me on the line. And again, if you want to get along, it's Friday the 7th and Saturday the 8th of October in London at Highgate International Church. Go to the website for more info, rethinkinghellconference.com. JT and Chris, thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Justin.
Well, let's take time just to look at some of your feedback to other shows. And this is going back to the show on Challenging Muslims with the Gospel that aired back in August. And just wanted to catch up with one or two of the comments that came on the back of that. That was Jay Smith and Beth Grove of Fander Apologetics talking about their ministry to Muslims. And it wasn't done in a dialogue style format, debate format with a Muslim. This was very much a conversation between the three of us from a Christian perspective. That didn't go down well with all unbelievable listeners who much prefer, you know, hearing that dialogical approach. But I felt I was able to justify to mess with the formula a bit on this one occasion. And Ray, in defense of that, was on the comments section. So to people who were saying that Jay and Beth were if you like, being too one-sided and so on, says that I think you can't expect a debate when one was never billed. I think it was pretty clear that one of the reasons why Jay came to the UK was to tackle radical Islam. Don't you remember him relating what happened when he applied for a UK passport? Don't you remember him explaining that he at times was beaten up by Muslims at the beginning? I don't remember him or Beth ever calling for hatred against Muslims, quite the reverse. Don't you remember him saying that after some of these heated sessions, the Muslims even bought them a sandwich or whatever afterwards? That hardly speaks of stirring up hatred. So Ray here responding to some of the commenters on underneath that show who felt that Jay and Beth were doing that. Ray goes on to say, people fail to grasp the difference between robust debate and inciting violence. I understand this in a very small way because I was involved in speaking to foreign students about the gospel 30 or so years ago. I was sometimes taken aback at how forceful Muslim students put forward their views, and they expect you to do the same. It's just a different culture, and you're trying to impose a foreign interpretation on what's happening rather than actually listening to the explanation. As well as a travel gent once pointed out to me, if you go to Australia, they take delight in insulting one another and having a good laugh about it. You know you're in with them if they do that to you, and they'd love it if you returned the favour. But you wouldn't do that in China. Anyway, thank you very much, Ray. This one from Josh said, I live near Toronto and listen to the podcast while I'm painting in my studio gallery. I was delighted to hear the episode with Jay Smith and Beth Grove, as I had the privilege of studying under them in London. Being from Canada, where most people are very passive when it comes to religious dialogue, I admit that I was at first sceptical of Fander's more confrontational approach. However, now, from personal experience, spending a month with them, hearing lectures, going down to Speaker's Corner to debate Muslims, visiting mosques and interacting with Muslims from radical to moderate and nominal, I can attest that both Jay and Beth and the rest of the team have the highest respect for Muslims in all of their engagements. Their desire to do the most rigorous Islamic scholarship comes from their deep love for the Muslim community. I was excited to hear more of the details for the next chapter of Jay's life, which will have such a crucial impact, especially in times like these, where there are increasing interest in understanding Islam. Lastly, excuse me, I want to encourage your listeners to consider taking a Fander course. It was very impactful in my life. Well, thank you, Josh. And I think a lot of people have been turned on to what Fander do. I understand from Beth that following that show's broadcast back in August, they had a real spike in interest in the courses and so on. So again, if you want to listen to that show, it's in the back catalogue. Go back to August and look for the show with Beth and Jay on Islam. And Jesse, last of all, says, I work with Muslim refugees in Portland, Oregon. Always interested in your episodes on Islam. I found the recent show on Challenging Muslims with the Gospel interesting and provocative, as always. Jay Smith and Beth Grove call the insider movement a heresy. You need to get someone on the show to push back on this. The insider movement is massive within Christian mission. Very popular Christian mission curriculum such as Perspectives, as well as mission organizations like Frontiers, teach a sort of insider movement as the norm. Perhaps someone like Jerry Trousdale, who wrote Miraculous Movements, or a speaker or author from Frontiers would be able to frame a response to Jay and Beth. Yes, that's a show I'd like to do, actually, Jesse, at some point. The insider movement being this view that Muslims who convert but don't, if you like, do that, they still go to mosque, they still live within the Islamic culture and so on, and whether that's the right way of going about things. Anyway, thanks for all those responses to that. Loads of responses to Derren Brown, and I'm just going to start with just a couple, and maybe we'll try and sneak some more in next week. But I had Derren Brown, who is here in the UK, just a masterful illusionist and mentalist, and of course a forthright atheist, was once a Christian, and I spoke to him across two shows, talking about his atheism, the resurrection, evidence for Christianity, and of course his miracle stage show, where he appears to replicate all kinds of miraculous stuff going on. Here's one from the Reverend John Monahan in Wiltshire, who says, "Your interview with Derren Brown was, I think, a prophetic call to the church to continue to expect the gospel to break in with signs and wonders so that unbelievers might believe, but to do so with absolute authenticity, integrity, and therefore credibility before the eyes of an increasingly sceptical but surprisingly open and spiritually seeking world. As a church minister and physiotherapist, I've witnessed God bring physical, emotional, and relational healing through both natural and supernatural processes. Whenever I preach on healing, I try to mention the reality of the God-given placebo effect, which can account for up to 30% of reported pain improvement, as well as how adrenaline can block pain receptors temporarily. I do this not to lower people's faith expectation for healing, but to encourage an authentic, credible atmosphere where we thank God for all healing and acknowledge that if God wants to heal supernaturally, he doesn't need our assistance or exaggerated reporting in order to please the minister. I've recently returned from a summer conference and I long for the leaders to increase their accountability and credibility on stage when praying for and reporting healings." And this one from Brian, who himself is an illusionist, has a fantastic show and ministry out in the States, actually. Brian Drake says, "Excellent job. You handled yourself really, really well. I loved where you took the interview and worked through the info that was given to you in a way that was kind, yet you stood your ground. To be fair, though, we don't all do cheesy gospel magic." Yes, that was something Derren referenced at one point in the interview. "I just happened to share the gospel during the message portion of an entertaining mentalism show." If you want to see Brian's stuff, actually, briandrakeshow.com. Oh, that's all we've time for. Out of time already. Loads more emails here on Derren Brown. It was such a popular episode, and I was really pleased that Derren himself was happy to share that across his Facebook and Twitter and so on. Again, if you want to get in touch, do feel free to email in. unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Time for me to go and leave you in hands of the profile. Keith Getty is up next, talking to John Pantry. Let me tell you what's coming next week. You're unbelievable. It's the multiverse, round two. Fine-tuning is fighting back. That's the theory anyway. You're going to be hearing a really interesting discussion between Luke Barnes, who in many ways has become one of the preeminent people in terms of looking and defending fine-tuning. And certainly in his latest book, which is just out, he talks about his concerns and scepticism around the issue of the multiverse. He's going to be in conversation with Max Andrews, who's doing a PhD on the philosophical issues associated with the multiverse. So come back as we look at the multiverse again. Same time next week. Until then, have a great week, and I'll see you then.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.